You are listening to The Point from MC3 in Lewistown, Pennsylvania. Check us out on the web at mc3church.org or find us on Facebook at mc3church. MC3, it's like nothing you'd expect.
Good morning. I have a, I guess it's a confession slash, I don't know, props out to people. Hello, Gene. I'm in for that all month. He promised me because I removed his row to put in the couches. So take it up with the ladies that work hard, unlike you, right? Because you never do any work. No, Gene, thank you. My confession has nothing to do with Gene or working hard. My confession has to do with I hate plumbing. Okay, now I guess on some level this confession is, wow, at least you can do plumbing, like I guess. As I said, I've said to you multiple times and many of you were a part of, we are remodeling our kitchen. And years ago I learned how to do sweat fitting, which uses a torch and it uses, you know, solder and flux so that you can take the copper pipes. This is the way it used to be done in the olden days. You would take a copper pipe and you would put the fitting on and then you would use your torch and, do the... there's not going to be an explosion. There, see? So you'd use the torch and you'd heat up the fitting, and then once it gets warm enough, then you would take out the solder and have to use it, and you'd put it on there. And I learned to do that. And one of the things, because I know you're all plumbing experts, and my confession being that I hate plumbing, and I guess the other side, the props are like plumbers. Like Ryan is not here today. I know Kyle does some plumbing. Like some of you guys that do this full time. Like at least bomb disposal people don't dispose of bombs like all the time every day. But I think plumbing is kind of the same category because you don't know what's going to happen until you're done. And with sweat fitting, at least when you put the solder on, you can see whether your connection is good because you'll see the solder all around it. And then you go for it. And I don't know if you realize this about plumbing, but for the most part, unless you're doing like a brand new house from scratch, but for the most part, the only way to test it is to turn on the water. And that is why I hate it, because it's like, I don't know. Like, is it the red wire or the blue wire? It's that kind of thing. And for a plumber, it's like that all the time. You know, it's this constant, like, taking, like, did it work? I don't know. Turn on the water. And if it works, then great. And if it doesn't work, you've got a mess everywhere. But at least with the soldering, at least with using the fixture, the torch to do some sweat fitting, you can see whether you've done a good job. But then, and this is what the rest of you can be a plumber, then about, 10 years ago, these things called shark bite or gator bites came onto the scene. I don't like these things. They're like the devil because they work in some weird witchcraft sorcery kind of way. I want you to watch this. Oh, I forgot my disconnector. I don't have it with me. It's in my other toolbox back there. But watch this, okay? So that, you have to heat up the fitting. You put all the solder around it and all that. For shark bite, ready? It's done. Like, for real. That's how these things work. And that doesn't make any sense. And you're putting, like, pressurized water through this line. I don't get it. And this is what I really hate about this. Because at least with solder, I'm in control. I can see if it's working. I can look at it and go, yeah, I did a good job. Yay me. All right. This doesn't make sense. There are physical laws that are not applying right now. And look, watch. I'm going to solder another one real quick. What? And then, I'm serious. Like, if you saw somebody come up, especially if you were like a child, be like, hey, look what I just did. And this is going to hold water. You'd be like, no, that's going to be a huge mess. But then you go over to the fitting or the what do you call it? A valve. There we go. And you turn it on. And it doesn't leak. And I have these in my house, and I don't understand what witchcraft or sorcery is going on here. There's like some kind of, just, it's crazy because it doesn't make sense. But I hate it because I can't tell if I did a good job. Because when I'm done, all I can do is just put the pieces together and sit back and trust that these guys, the manufacturers, knew what they're doing, that they know what they're talking about when they made these things. And if this is like way over your head, because like I don't get it, all I do is turn on the water and it's there. Yes, great. But for those of you that have kind of an inkling of how this works, this doesn't make sense. And I hate it because I have to depend on something that I can't control. And I want to talk to you as we're continuing this series about rest, about sometimes it's important for us to step back and rest because it takes things out of our control and puts them in God's control and puts them in His hands. And I'll just be straight. It's okay to not like it. It's okay to be uncomfortable. But there's a beautiful thing when we're able to step back and say, you know what? I'm just going to leave this in God's hands. And let Him do it. And we'll talk about why that works and why that's a good thing in a moment. But the point that I want you to get today is this. And that is that rest allows a driven person to trust. And I want to define driven because in the last 2 months, since Kara has turned 16, let me turn off the gas here. You know, we're all down with not starting a fire. Okay. In the last few months, since Kara has turned 16, the word driven has taken on a whole different meaning. But if you smell fumes, it's not a big deal. If I pass out, it is a big deal. Okay, the idea of driven, I'm not talking about here someone driving a car. I'm not even talking about being motivated and doing a good job or anything like that. I'm talking about this idea where we are just in the constant state of going and of doing and of accomplishing and of making things happen. And there's a book I read years ago. It was called Ordering Your Private World. And in the author compares this idea of a driven person versus a called person. And a called person can do the same thing, but the motivation is different. The motivation isn't about me. It's not about accomplishing. It's not about making sure that my fittings look good. It's about just trusting that God's got this in His hands. And so with this idea of rest, for some of you, and let me be honest, I think all of us, there's a driven aspect to our lives in different areas. And rest allows us to trust. And specifically to trust God. And that, honestly, even though it might be a scary place to be, is an incredibly wonderful place to be. Because you suck. Don't say suck. You're not as good at doing things as God. I'm not as good at doing things as God. And when I try to make it happen and work it my way, it's not going to be good enough. It's not going to be as incredibly and amazing and wonderful as God doing it. And so this idea of rest lets us step back and give a chance for us to just trust God. And as we were talking about last week, we interviewed Justin up here and talking about the importance of rest for our bodies and how rest is so important. And you're going to have a chance in your prime groups to review a little bit of that last week, because last week was a setup for where we're going this whole month. But there's a lot of these myths related to rest and these ideas that rest is bad and that means I'm lazy and all this stuff. And we talked about last week, no, this is actually something that God tells us to do, and Jesus demonstrated, the Son of God and fully man, demonstrated rest for us. So I want to talk about this, and we're going to look at a passage here in, I'm totally uncomfortable with this just sitting here. We're going to look at a passage in Exodus. And I need to say a couple of things about this passage in Exodus. What's going on in the book of Exodus and why it's called Exodus is because the Israelite people, through some interesting circumstances, found themselves, incredible circumstances, I should say, found themselves in Egypt. And they were under the control of, at that point in their history, a ruthless overlord Pharaoh guy. Pharaoh was just the title of the person that was in charge of Egypt. And they were in this spot, and they were being oppressed into slavery. It was an awful thing. And the people cried out to God, and God said, okay, I'm going to deliver you from this, and I'm going to take you to this land that I promised to Abraham, your great-great-great-great-grandfather. And you're going to go there. And so where we're going to pick up the story is that God brought them out through miracles. I mean, you probably read or heard of the story, you know, the Prince of Egypt or the movie The Ten Commandments, or what was the other one? Exodus Gods and Kings, which is meh. But the idea is that through these plagues, these wonders, God brought them out of Egypt, of ultimately crossing the Red Sea. Miraculously, God parted the waters. They walked through on dry land and lead them into the desert. And they're getting ready to go into this land that God has promised. And that is where we're picking up the story, because the context matters to what's going on. So we're going to be in Exodus chapter 16. We'll turn on the house lights if you have a paper Bible. If you have the free YouVersion app, just tap on Exodus, which is the second book of the Bible, Genesis, Exodus, and then tap on 16, where we're going to be, and looking at this idea. Now, I'm going to tell you the story because it's a really long passage, so we're going to kind of talk through it. And I'm, as you can see, like, there's going to be a whole rub through here because I'm trying not to stand up, but, you know, I'm resting. So, I want to talk about this idea of sleeping in on Sabbath mornings, because what we're going to be talking about here is the Sabbath. And last week we mentioned this idea that God rested on the seventh day, and he called that day a holy day. God said, it's not because I'm too tired, it's not because I don't have what it takes, it's because I want to set an example of rest, and a holy meaning setting aside as special, as unique. This day is important. And that day, the seventh day of the week, by the way, is Saturday. Is the Sabbath, the Shabbat, is the Hebrew word that the Jewish people used, and they still use, for the day of rest, which is Saturday. So just to kind of break down some of these barriers, like if you're like, well, do not, you know, Sunday is the Sabbath, so we don't work, or we don't, it's not. Sorry, read the Bible. But this idea of Saturdays, God said, I'm setting aside this Sabbath. And the word Sabbath, the Shabbat, the word means to cease, to end, to sever. Like, the word means, I mean, you could use that word if you were, like, hanging out with someone and I don't know, say you were in Oaxaca and it was time to eat chicken for dinner. And then they said, hey, Sean, do you want to Shabbat the head of this chicken? I'm like, dude, I'm totally country. Like, yeah, bring it on, because I'm farmer boy. Isn't that like a Little House on the Prairie thing? And so then they gave me a serrated knife. And I proceeded to, I won't go any further in case some of you are squeamish, but I cut the head off of that chicken, and I Shabbatted that head. I severed it. I cut it off slowly and arduously, and it endured a long, painful death. Apparently, he's supposed to use a cleaver, but they thought that was funny to get, you know, me to do it with a serrated knife where I sawed my way through the head of that chicken. But why am I saying this? So Shabbat means to sever, to stop, to end. And this idea is we're setting up here about the Shabbat, the Saturday, the Sabbath. And so God is setting up a principle essentially for sleeping in on Saturdays for the Jewish people. And I want to clarify as we get into this, that this is God speaking to the people of Israel. This is not for us today. As we get into the New Testament, you'll even see the literal rules that we're talking about here. When we get to the New Testament, Jesus actually, as far as the law goes, he's like, you know, the Sabbath, the Saturday, is not to be kept the way it was for all these generations. But there's a principle here. And that is, as we look at this passage, God was saying to these people, while you're in, and you'll see why it doesn't apply to us today, while you're in the desert and this miraculous food appears every morning, here are the rules, here are the standards that I want you to follow. And again, there's some principles here that we can take away when it comes to sleeping in on Sabbath mornings. Let me just ask a quick question. This is just, I'm feeling old. How many of you actually understand what it meant to watch Saturday morning cartoons? Just raise your hand if that was a real thing. See, like, why would you watch cartoons on Saturday mornings? Because that was the only time they were on. That was it. You got up. And you had to watch cartoons on Saturday mornings. There was no like, oh, I'll just watch this on Netflix now. Or no, that was the only time. But anyway, so sleeping in on Sabbath morning. So the first thing we see in this passage, the first principle that we can take away is that rest shows our obedience. Rest shows our obedience. As we look at this passage, we're going to see that this was a command that God gave to the people to rest, to take off on the Sabbath, to take this break, to cease on that day. And again, I think that word is so unique and special because it doesn't mean to kind of like, eh. No, it is a sever, a stop, a cease and desist order for work. And so this is what we see here in the first part of this passage. It says, then the whole community of Israel set out, I can't read all of it there, set out and journeyed into the wilderness of Sin. That was the name of the place. It didn't mean they were getting into sin. Between Elim and Mount Sinai. They arrived there on the 15th day of the second month, 1 month after leaving the land of Egypt. So again, just catching us up on the story. There too, the whole community of Israel complained about Moses and Aaron. And the word complain means to grumble against and blame. Like they were mad at Moses and Aaron because like a month, people, 30 days earlier, they saw God part the Red Sea and they walked through on dry ground. 31-ish days earlier, they saw God perform incredible, well, at least that one was the Passover, where God actually went through and an angel for the people that did not obey God, the firstborn child was killed. Like, there's serious things going on here. They saw the plagues of frogs and all this stuff. And 1 month later, are already complaining, but that's not the point for today. So they were complaining to Moses there, and he said, "If only the Lord had killed us back in Egypt," they moaned. "There we sat around pots filled with meat and ate all the bread we wanted." And again, off the subject, but dude, are we not idiots like these people? You were in slavery. It was awful. And they're going, "But if we were back there, we had our bellies full." And I don't know if you're like this, but I just feel like God could look at me and be like, Sean, you were in slavery. Quit your whining. Anyway, there we sat back and said, "Now you have brought us into the wilderness to starve us all to death." So they're out here complaining. They're like, "Okay, now we're here in the desert. We're gonna starve to death." And then he goes on and says, "Then the Lord said to Moses, 'Look, I'm going to rain down food from heaven for you. Each day the people can go out and pick up as much food as they need for that day.'" Excuse me. And we'll get to that in a second. And then he says, "I will test them in this." And the word test, by the way, does not mean tempt. When you see the Bible and you hear something about God testing people, we're often like, "Oh, God is going to make him sin." No, actually, the Bible is very clear that God does not tempt anyone to sin. But this test is like, I want to see if they're really going to put their money where their mouth is. They're really going to back up what they say they believe. Are they for real? Are they really what they call themselves to be? I'm going to test them in this to see whether or not they will follow my instructions. "So on the sixth day, they will gather food, and when they prepare it, there will be twice as much as usual." So just setting this up, that God is saying, I want these people to rest. You're going to gather something every day of the week, except on the sixth day, you're going to gather twice as much. And I want to see if you're willing to obey me. I want to see if you're willing to follow the commands that I've given you. And so for us, this principle is that, you know, there is a point where rest allows us just to obey God. And we talked about that last week. I mean, this isn't God's suggestion. This isn't like, you know, take it or leave it when you get a chance. This is a command, and the idea of resting is a way for us to demonstrate our obedience. Do you really believe God is who he is? Do you really believe God can do what he says he's going to do? Because if you don't, then ignore it. But if you do, you need to start living it. So rest shows our obedience. The second thing, and this is where it gets awesome, rest shows God's power. And when we get into this idea of resting, it means we have to step back and say, you know what? This doesn't even make any sense, but I'm going to trust that the manufacturer knows what he's doing. This idea of resting for us, again, especially when we talk about a driven person that wants to do and make and succeed and solve and fix and get it and you know, do, rest is the opposite of that. We're like, no. If I'm resting, then it's not going to get done. And sometimes we are able to step back. When we rest, we step back and watch God get it done instead. And that's a good place to be. So continuing on in the passage in verse 6, it goes on and says that, "So Moses and Aaron said to all the people of Israel, 'By evening, you will realize it was the Lord.'" You get that? So God says, I'm going to do something incredibly miraculous. And God says that, and Moses says, he's speaking to the people. By the way, you're going to see a lot of this interchange between Moses said or the Lord said. God spoke through Moses and Aaron to the people. He spoke to them and they would share it. So it's kind of it's essentially the same thing. And he says, "By the evening, you will realize that it was the Lord who brought you out of the land of Egypt." So when this is done, there's going to be no question whose power this is. There's going to be no question about whether you did it or God did it. He goes on and says, "In the morning, you will see the glory of the Lord." The glory is the idea of all the encompassing amazingness of God. You're going to see, you're going to know it was the Lord because he has heard your complaints, which are against him and not us. Moses said, just, hey, covering all my bases here. It's not me you're mad at. What have we done that you should complain about us? Then Moses added, the Lord will give you meat to eat in the evening and bread to satisfy you in the morning, for he has heard all your complaints against him. What have we done? Yes, your complaints are against the Lord, not against us. And so again, Moses is like, you've been complaining against us, but just keep in mind that we're just obeying what God tells us to do. And if you're mad at us, you're mad at God. Just make sure we're square on that. And then says that, you know, God's going to do something here. And you're going to go, wow, God is amazing. And here's the problem, and we'll continue on. Let me read the rest of the passage. But so then Moses said to Aaron, announce this to the entire community of Israel. Present yourselves before the Lord, for he has heard your complaining. And God is just gracious here. Like, I don't know about you, especially as a parent. When my kids complain and then continue to complain and then complain some more, my first response isn't, oh, well, since you're complaining, let me help you out. But that's how gracious God is to us, because we're just like little complaining, whining children. But anyway, again, that's not part of what we're talking about today. As Aaron spoke to the whole community of Israel, they looked out toward the wilderness. There they could see the awesome glory of the Lord in the cloud. So God's glory like showed up in a physical way. They could see it. Then the Lord said to Moses, I have heard the Israelites' complaints. Now, we could talk all day about this complaint thing. But anyway, now tell them, in the evening you will have meat to eat, and in the morning you will have all the bread you want. Then you will know that I am the Lord your God. And let me just be honest, this idea of rest, this idea of stopping, means that we have to put it in God's hands. It means we have to trust the manufacturer. It means we have to trust the one that makes it, that what he says is going to happen. And here's the thing about that. When we do that, when we're willing to step out in that act of faith, or actually it's going to be sort of an inaction of faith, if you will, we get to see God show up and go, wow, God is incredible. God is amazing. And one of the things that I hear from people, I mean, being a pastor and have all these people like, hey, can I talk to you? And I don't mean that in a negative way. But one of the things is like, I just wish I could see God. I wish I could see God do something incredible in my life. And almost every time I'm like, have you given him a chance? Have you given him the chance to do something incredible in your life? Or are you handling it all yourself? Is it all in your control? Is it all in your power? Are you the one providing and supplying and meeting all the needs and doing everything and not even giving God a chance? And I'm not saying that God couldn't do that. But this idea of saying, I'm going to step back and watch God work. And it's hard. I'm not saying it's easy. It's hard going to that valve and turning in the water. It is stressful, especially when it's like in a wall and you have brand new drywall and all like, duh. But when you do that, you go, wow, this stuff's amazing. I need to get some more of this. This God's amazing. I need to get some more of him. And so rest gives us that opportunity to show God's power. Sometimes we are so driven that we don't even give him a chance to show his power because we've got it all solved. We've got it all figured out. We've got it all fixed. And one of the songs we actually sang this morning, this was in my notes, Corinthians talks about how we have treasures in jars of clay. Clay jars are junk. They're fragile. They're broken. Why? To show that everything in us is from God and not from us. When we are broken, when we are weak, when we rest, when we stop, God then shows up and God gets the glory. And by the way, God is the star of this story. God is the star of this story, this life that we are living. It's not you. And I've talked about this before. I know Francis Chan wrote this in a book. You know, imagine bringing everybody to a big movie premiere. Like inviting all your friends. I'm the star of this movie. And everybody shows up and they come like, yeah, let me see you. You know, where are you? And, you know, half hour, 45 minutes into the movie, there's like the back of that guy's head. You're like, that was me. I was guy by popsicle stand. I was an extra. And everybody around you'd be like, you are not the star. You're an idiot. And that's the point. God is the star of this story. So when we rest, it gives us a chance to see God's power. And then that kind of ties into the next thing here is when we rest, rest shows God's provision. It also is a reminder that, you know what, it's not about you. And it's not about me making it all work. It's not about me being the provider. It's not about me making it happen because you're not. And we're going to talk about this in a little bit. You're not the provider. But when we rest, we are forced to allow God to come through for us. And again, we talked about this last week. I'm not talking about laziness. I'm not talking about an excuse to just sleep all day and play video games. I'm just resting like the Lord told me. No, I'm talking about what we said last week too, the idea of getting away with Jesus. What is God calling you to rest from? But when we do that, we can see God provide. And then that's where the passage continues. It says, that evening, vast numbers of quail flew in. I think those are birds. I probably wouldn't have known that before I moved to Mifflin County. Just confession. They flew in and covered the camp. Obviously, they ate quail. And by the way, that was a miraculous thing. That wasn't like normal. And then it says, and then the next morning, the area around the camp was wet with dew. When the dew evaporated, a flaky substance as fine as frost blanketed the ground. So these little things all over the ground. The Israelites were puzzled when they saw it. What is it? They asked each other. The Hebrew word for what is it? Manna. Manna means what is it? So if you've heard of manna, that's what we're talking about here. They had no idea what it was. And the Moses told them, it is the food the Lord has given you to eat. These are the Lord's instructions. So they show up and they're like, what's going on? What is this stuff? God said he was going to provide for you. And now he has in a miraculous way. And if you were out busy doing your thing and working and earning it, you would never have seen this miraculous thing happen. God says, trust me, I'm going to provide. Next day, God provided. Now he says, each household should gather as much as it needs. As much as it needs. Pick up 2 quarts for each person in your tent. And just understand that idea of tent. Basically, it means for your household, for the people in your home. Get enough for everyone in your tent. And so the idea being that usually one member of the family, often the father of the family, the patriarch might even be the great-grandfather of all the generations that would live with them in their big old tent. And we'll go out and he says, for every person in your tent, get 2 quarts of manna. And then he goes on and says, so the people of Israel did as they were told. Some gathered a lot and some only a little. So obviously for some families, like the Hales, you know, Chris is going out. He's gathering a lot more than other families that have one or two kids or, you know, single people. Like, there's definitely a different amount. So, but it's 2 quarts per person. So it says some gathered a lot, some gathered a little. But when they measured it out, and listen to this, everyone had just enough. Those who gathered a lot had nothing left over. And those who had gathered only a little had enough. Each family had just what it needed. And so in this spot here, the people not only had to, they watched God miraculously in an amazing way show up on the scene, but when they trusted him, when they rested, when they didn't disobey, when they didn't get more than they needed, God said, you have just enough. And as the great philosopher Mary Poppins once said, enough is as good as a feast. I mean, we just passed a billboard yesterday, and I don't know if you've ever been a part of the Shady Maple experience. That is... there's something that's just messed up in all that. And it is now officially the United States' largest smorgasbord. It's down in Lancaster County. And it's just, your eyes pop because there is so much freaking food. It's every kind, any way, any what you want. But here's the crazy thing. Like, I don't know how big your stomach is, but it's probably somewhere in the range of, I really don't know. Maybe they're golf ball size. I don't know how big they are, but like this. It's probably in the range of this. I've got a professional telling me that. So it's probably in the range of this. And you know how much of this can fit that entire huge smorgasbord? This much. The cool, crazy, wild, like blowing my mind thing is they charge you like $30 per person to go and eat the same amount of food. I mean, it's more than that now. To eat the same amount of food that you get at McDonald's, which I get it. For like $5. And the point is that it doesn't matter how many things are there. You can only eat so much. And they get you on the wow factor, on the whoa, look at all this stuff. But God here shows up on the scene and says, get what I tell you, and you're going to find that that is enough. That I am providing for you. I am meeting your needs. And even though you're like, what about them? They're getting more. No. Not about them, about you. Trust me, and I will show up. Trust me, and I will provide for your needs. And when you do that, they did. Everyone had exactly what they needed. They had just enough. And God, like we said earlier, God is always going to meet our needs. But sometimes we need to step back and let him. And let him show up. Because here's the thing too, like, I don't know, if it was up to me, I would bring the Shady Maple. Boom, have it all. And my kids are like, Dad, I'm so sick. Eat it. We paid for this food. You finish that food, but dude! Oh, I gotta stop doing that. It'll make me throw up for real. But you know, and like Sean's idea of provision is probably more than enough. Or be like, hey, that's a really expensive piece of whatever bacon. I mean, bacon's always worth it, but you know, like eat it. But Dad, I'd like something more. I eat your bacon. Like, you know, we don't do a good enough job. But when God shows up, it's always just enough. It's always exactly what we need. Not too much, not too little. Exactly. And when we rest and we step back and say, okay, God, this is your thing. He shows up with just the right amount. And we're going to come back to that idea in a second. And then the fourth thing we see in this passage here, the principle is that rest shows our trust. Kind of tied to the first thing. The first thing is God saying, do it. Are we really going to obey him or not? The last thing here says God says, do it. Are we going to trust that he's going to come through? And that's the scary part. That's the part where you're like, I don't know. Can I trust God? Because we think about the people around us or the people we can count on. I mean, we've all been let down by our parents or by important people we respect and trust or whatever. Because nobody ever really comes through. And so maybe God's like that too. But God isn't. And so we have to be willing to trust and obey him and say, okay, I'm going to stop and trust God and demonstrate that God can do what he says he's going to do. So there's a little bit longer. I'm going to read through it a little bit faster. So it says, then Moses told them, do not keep any of it until morning. So get enough you need for today. Don't keep it till morning. But some of them didn't listen and kept some of it until the morning. By then, it was full of maggots and had a terrible smell. I don't have time to tell you the story about the subs that were sitting on our counter or in our trash can and we didn't realize it. So Moses was really angry with them. He says, take enough. Enough is all you need. They're like, oh, I'm going to take a little more. God doesn't know what I need. No, God does know what you need. And when you take more, it stinks. Then he goes on and says, after this, the people gathered the food morning by morning. And we're talking about years of God providing this way. Morning by morning, each family according to his need. Some got more, some got less, but it was according to the 2 quarts per family. As the sun became hot, the flakes that they had not picked up melted and disappeared. So God says, I'm providing it, get what you need, and the rest of it's gone. There was nothing left over. On the sixth day, the day before the Shabbat, the day before the Sabbath, the day before the rest day, they gathered twice as much as usual. 4 quarts for each person instead of 2. Now here's where it gets interesting. So this every day, get enough for what you need, get enough for what you need, get enough for what you need, get enough for... On the sixth day, get twice as much. And this is how things go. Then the gossiping started. The leaders of the community, hey, Moses, there's some people over there getting twice as much. They're getting more than me. Explain this. And Moses told them, this is what the Lord commanded. Tomorrow will be a day of complete rest. Tomorrow will be a Shabbat, a Sabbath, a day of rest, a holy Sabbath day set apart for the Lord. So bake or boil as much as you want today and set aside what is left for tomorrow. Now, again, day one. This is crazy. I think I need more than what God said I should get. Oh, day two. It stinks, but there's more there. Okay, I'll get it. I'll get a little more. Okay, it stinks. It's maggots. Next day. Okay, just enough. They're getting the routine. Every morning, go out, get what you need. Now it's the sixth day. And God says, look, I want you to take twice as much. He's like, God, I remember those maggots. And they were stanky nasty. So you're not going to get me on this one. And Moses said, no, God has set apart the seventh day, this Sabbath day for you, so that you can trust him. Set it apart is holy. So gather twice as much today. So they put a sum aside until morning, just as Moses had commanded. And in the morning, the leftover food was wholesome and good, without maggots or odor. So God said, trust me. Trust me on this. I said it so you can count on me. I want you to rest. I want you to have to trust me. If God said, go out every day and get all you can and get it, because it's up to you, figure it out. God says, no, I want you to rest intentionally. I want you to cease. I want you to stop. I want you to sever your work, because when you do that, you are going to have to depend on me. And let me tell you, I am way better and way more dependable and trustworthy than you will ever be. So Moses said, eat this food today, for today is the Sabbath day dedicated to the Lord. There will be no food on the ground today. You may gather the food for 6 days, but the seventh day is the Sabbath. There will be no food on the ground today. They're like, it's almost like they don't quite get it. He has to keep reminding them. So some of the people, he said it like three times, some of the people went out anyway on the seventh day, but they found no food. And the Lord asked Moses, how long will these people refuse to obey my commands and instructions? Don't you get it? They must realize the Sabbath is the Lord's gift to you. That is why he gives you a two-day supply on the sixth day, so there will be enough for 2 days. On the Sabbath day, you must go. You must each stay in your place. And that word stay in your place means to rest, to dwell, to relax. Because God created us. And he knows that we cannot survive as driven people. We cannot survive going and going and going. We need rest. So he says, rest that day. I'm going to provide twice as much the day before so that on the Sabbath you can rest. Don't go out and pick any food on the seventh day. So the people did not gather any food on the seventh day. Yeah, that was at the end of the passage. Then they gathered food the seventh day. And the next verse actually says that manna was awesome. It tasted like honey cakes and wafers. Like it was like donuts every day. And God said, this is your wholesome food. It said wholesome. Exactly. I just thought, yeah, thank you. Thank you, God. But of course, if they went and did it themselves, they would probably be eating like Bear Grylls. Okay? I don't mean like grilling bear. I mean like Bear Grylls eating, you know, grubs and sucking sap out of tree stems and drinking their own. Anyway, but the point is, that when we rest, it shows our trust. And, and here's a quote that I have here. It says, by observing the Sabbath, Israel had to trust that God would provide enough in their rest. Because they can't do it, God has to come through. And it forces that. And maybe, I don't know, I find like I need some of these moments where I'm forced to trust God because on my own, I'm like, no, I want to figure it out. I want to fix it. I'm driven. I'm going to do it. I'm going to make it happen. God's like, just trust me and watch me come through. I'm like, no, I got this one, God. But I have a quote here from Francis Chan. It was a different book I was reading by him. He says, I want my life to be so marked by dependence on God that if he doesn't come through, I'm screwed. Like, do we live lives like that where we really depend on God, or do we work it all out? Do our bank accounts all work it out? Does everything that we have fit? And we fixed it. We solved it. This is how it's going to be. I've got my plan. Here it is, God. I hope you like it. If you don't, it doesn't matter because I've worked it out. Or do we get to the spot where we're really willing to trust God? And that's what was going on with the Israelites here. They had to trust because God said, this is the way it's going to be. I'm going to provide this for you. You need to take just what you need. And on the sixth day, you're going to take twice as much because I'm going to come through in a completely different way where this stuff is going to last for 2 days. Because I'm God and I'm in control. And you need to trust me and trust that I know what I'm doing. And so all of these things, rest shows our obedience. Rest shows God's power. Rest shows God's provision, and rest shows our trust. And that was the principles that we can take from this passage with Israel. Because the point is that rest allows a driven person to trust. And some of us need to trust. Some of us need that because we go, we solve, we do, we make, we fix, we conquer. And in all of that, there's never any, what does God want? Because I've got it all solved, I don't really care what God wants. But rest allows, or you could even say forces, a driven person to trust him. And he is always going to do better than you think you can, than you can do. So let's kind of break this down for the next few minutes here. And you'll have a chance in your prime groups this week to really discuss these and challenge each other in your group. If you're not in a prime group, I'd encourage you to sign up out in the lobby there because there's some practical things that are going to happen with this. But I want to talk about some obstacles for the driven. Like, again, I think there's a part of all of us that's driven. Some of you are just driven people. And if you ask someone, they'd probably describe you that way. And I'm not saying that's necessarily bad, but the question is, what is driving you? Is it your desire to solve, to fix, to accomplish, to do? Or is it because God is saying this is something you need to do? And we just talked in our elders meeting last week, you know, the importance of excellence. Like, we are serving the God of the universe. The God that didn't just give us a leftover angel. No, the God that sent his only son to die for us. So we can do things well. But the idea of driven is what is motivating us? What is pushing us? And the thing is, I can't see your heart. And you can't see my heart. But you know your own heart. And you need to go to God and say, what do I need to do? So let's talk about some of these obstacles. Some things that we need to overcome if we're really going to be able to rest and trust God. The first thing is what I'm calling the obstacle of provision. I said we were going to come back to this, so here we are. Rest forces us to realize that God is the provider. Rest forces us to realize that God is the provider. As driven people, no, we think it's up to us. We think it's our job to get a better job. We think it's our job to get more jobs. We think it's our job to do more work, to accomplish more, to solve more, to do all these things. And you miss something. And let me just break it down the way James does in the letter that James wrote. He says, don't be deceived, my brothers and sisters. Don't be deceived. Don't buy the lie. Don't buy into what this world is telling you, that it's up to you to provide for your family. Don't get sucked in. Don't think that it's your job to make sure everything happens. He says, don't be deceived. Every good and perfect gift is from working harder and getting the promotion and making sure that other things fall apart. That is how you get every good and perfect gift. That is not what he says. Every good and perfect gift is from above, coming down from the Father of heavenly lights, who does not change like shifting shadows. Rest forces us to say, God, you're the provider. This is about you. It's not about me. And some of us need to step back and say, maybe we need to let God come through and provide. Because we're so busy doing it ourselves that we don't see him show up. We don't see him work out the details. We talked about this last month with Herod. You know, he thought he was the king of the Jews, to be specific. And when it turned out this other guy showed up on the scene, he took matters into his own hands and decided he's going to solve the situation. He's going to kill all of the boys 2 years younger in Bethlehem. But that's just the same thing. We're not the provider. You are not the provider. It is not your job to provide for your family. It is your job to lead your family to trust God's provision. That is the job that you have. And rest forces that. And some of you are working so hard and doing so much, and other things are falling apart that are more important than, quote unquote, providing for your family. Second thing, second obstacle is the obstacle of satisfaction. Rest pushes us to be satisfied with enough. Are you satisfied with enough? The Jewish people, the Israelite people, they could gather more. Like, oh, I'm going to have more. And then it was maggots. Because God said, no, I'm giving you enough. Enough is good as a feast. Enough is as good as a feast. You have all that you need. And rest forces us to be satisfied with enough. This is what Paul writes to this young leader, Timothy, in 1 Timothy. He says, true godliness. So there you go, right away. With contentment is itself great wealth. True godliness with contentment is itself great wealth. After all, we brought nothing with us when we came into the world. John and Liz just had a baby yesterday. I'm pretty sure there was nothing else with that baby. And if we knew, I'm going out on a limb here. But I think we could ask Liz and she would say, no, it was just a baby. Oh, and there was a 401k and a savings account and a checkbook. It was a little awkward, but, you know, we dealt with it. And I understand that John actually delivered the baby. So, no, we didn't bring anything into the world. And you can't take anything with us when we leave it. We were at a funeral yesterday for my brother's, plural, mother-in-law. My brother's both married sisters, and they're twins. And my brothers are twins, the sisters are not. And their mother-in-law passed away from cancer this week. And all that was left behind was her legacy. She didn't take anything else with her. Or everything that was left behind, except for her. Like, she didn't take anything else with her into eternity with Jesus. That's what happens. Like, you don't bring it with you. And so he says, so if we have enough food and clothing, let us be content. Are you content with enough? Or do you need more? Or do you need bigger? Or do you need better? Or do you need cooler, faster, smaller, technologicaler? He says, let us be content. But some people who long to be rich, and this word rich doesn't just mean money, but it means stuff, rich in the world sense of having so many things, fall into temptation, are trapped by many foolish and harmful desires that plunge them into ruin and destruction. For the love, by the way, this is often misquoted, the love of money is the root of all kinds of evil. And some people, craving money, have wandered from the true faith and pierce themselves with many sorrows. Paul says, look, Timothy, be satisfied with enough, because people that are not satisfied with enough and need more and want more and need to get bigger and better and faster, their life is miserable. And they're like, God, why is my life so miserable? God's like, because I said to just trust me and let me provide enough, because enough is all you need. But he says some people have wandered away from that and pierced themselves with many griefs and sorrows and pain. And I'm not saying that all the pain we have in life is because of that, but it's a fair thing to say, okay, am I overwhelmed, stressed out, burned out, worn out, mean, angry, bitter, because I'm so interested in getting more and not being satisfied? God provided the Israelites exactly what they needed. And of course, in the end, getting all that extra stuff is worthless. It's a worthless pursuit, especially because you end up missing out on things that really matter. And again, at that funeral yesterday, no one stood up and said, man, Ginny had a lot of money. It was so great. I got it all. Nobody stood up and said, her car was awesome and it came to me. Yay, thanks. No, it was all about her love for Jesus and the way she cared about her family. Things that matter to what people remember. And no one's going to say that at your funeral, sorry. They're going to talk about what you actually left behind that mattered. And so are you going to spend and invest your life in pursuing something that doesn't matter? Are you going to be satisfied with what you have? Are you going to be satisfied with enough? And rest forces that. Because we step back and say, okay, God, I could work more and do more, but instead I'm going to spend this time learning how to play stinking Super Smash Brothers. I don't understand the game. My kids are like, here, Dad, it's easy. Take the controller. And you can play four players. So I'm like, all right, I'm in. Oh, you're dead, Dad. I don't understand. I'm like, how do you do it? Oh, just push the buttons. No, you're not just pushing the buttons. Because you're like destroying me, and I'm just pushing the buttons, and I keep falling off the edge. And it goes, boom. But you know what? I think the time worth resting, I guess you could say, playing Super Smash Brothers with my kids, even though it makes no sense, is worth more than, I don't know, picking up a second job or finishing all the plumbing, stupid plumbing, on the kitchen. Because sometimes enough is enough, and we need to be able to say and be satisfied with enough. And finally, the last obstacle is the obstacle of limitation. And here's something I think the other two were like, yeah, I get it. I need to trust God. God's the provider. Yeah, I get it. You know, I need to be satisfied and not be greedy. But I think the last one, this obstacle of limitation, is something that we overlook. When we are so busy doing. When we are busy doing and achieving and accomplishing and solving and working and doing all these things, we miss the fact that, well, as it says here, rest allows us to admit that it's not all up to us. It's not up to you. The world is not on your shoulders. The world is not on my shoulders. The church of MC3 is not on my shoulders. And let me tell you, you should be very glad, because I am a horrible leader. The only thing that I have to offer is my willingness to follow God's lead. And some of us think that it's about us and doing it. And I need to do this. And if I don't do it, no one else will. And if I don't step in, this isn't going to happen. And God needs me more than anything else. But we miss that. You know what? That's not true. You are limited on purpose. Let's look at this passage. In 1 Corinthians chapter 12, Paul is writing to this church he planted in Corinth. He is talking to a church plant similar to MC3 in a city called Corinth, a town. And he says, even so, the body, just being clear here, and if you need me to bring Justin back up front to interview him in case this is a little bit too hard to understand, that your body is not made up of one part, but of many. There's a lot of them. Now, if the foot should say, because I am not a hand, I don't belong to the body, it would not for that reason stop being part of the body. Your foot, you know, if your foot talked, that would be weird. And if it talked to your hand, that would be weird too. But metaphorically speaking, your foot can't say, oh, I'm not part of the body. No, just because I'm different. And if the ear should say, well, because I'm not an eye, I don't belong to the body, it would not for that reason to stop being part of the body. No. If the whole body were an eye, Justin would be going crazy in business. That Justin. He's an optometrist. But where would the sense of hearing be? If the whole body were an ear, where would the sense of smell be? Like, no, we know that our body has different parts and we're glad for that. And he goes on and says, but in fact, God has placed the parts in the body, every one of them, just as he wanted them to be. If they're all one part, where would the body be? As it is, there are many parts but one body. Again, are we clear on that? Have you looked around that all of this is different? We can sing a song about Father Abraham and his many sons. He grew up in church, left arm, right arm. Had nothing to do with Father Abraham and his sons. I don't understand, but it was like, you're preschool, you're in church, and we need to slow you down. So, anyway, but he goes on and says, the eye cannot say to the hand, I don't need you. And the head cannot say to the feet, I don't need you. And sometimes when we feel like it's all up to us and it's our job to do it and to make it happen, you are saying to the other people in this body, because he goes on and says, now you are the body of Christ. And each one of you is a part of it. And when we have this mentality that it's all up to us, you are robbing the people around you of the ability to use their gifts. Because you're going, it's all up to me, it's all on my shoulders. And of course, that does require that the rest of you use your gifts too, because we're counting on you. I need my feet. Kendra needs her wrist, as she's learned this week with a carpal tunnel diagnosis. Like, you get it. We need these parts to work. And if we think it's all up to us, we miss that. And I wrote this in my notes here for what it's worth. Here's three things that happen when we do it all, when we feel like it's all up to us. First, we burn out. Because we're doing more than we can handle. God never designed us to do it all. And so we burn out and quit and walk away from whatever that is. Whether that's ministry, whether that's your job, whether that's your marriage. We quit and walk away because we're doing more than we can handle. The second thing that happens when we try to do it all is that our product is subpar. Because you're doing things that you're not gifted to do. And I'll just be... I think this is fairly obvious. I feel God has gifted me in teaching. I love it. I love to do it. I feel like people walk away going, hey, I understood something different. Praise God, he's doing something. I'm just not a compassion, mercy guy. Like, oh, can I put my... I do it because I should, and it's appropriate and all that, but it's not a natural thing for me to come alongside you and love you and encourage you. It's like, suck it up and deal, dude. But there are some of you that you can just go, hi. And this person's going to be like, you're so right. You're so good at you. Because God has gifted us in different ways, and we all work together. And so for me to try to be like, I'm going to quit this thing, and I'm going to be a counselor. Like, again, I don't want people like, oh, he's not a counselor. Like, it's just not where my gifts are. And you would be like, he's really bad. And I think you've seen people that have stepped into roles that are not where God has gifted them. And they don't enjoy it. And they don't do a good job. Because God has not gifted them to do that. And so for us, when we decide to do it all, not only do we get burnt out because we're doing more than we should, we also create a subpar product because you're doing something you shouldn't be doing. And the third thing is that you, as I said earlier, you rob for other Christ followers of the ability for them to use the gifts that God has given them. And so for you to do it all, there's people around you, you're essentially saying, you know what, you don't matter. You're not good enough. Because you're not an eye, and I'm an eye. You're not a foot, and I'm a foot. So you're not good enough. But these are obstacles, and I'm well over time here. These are obstacles that we need to recognize in our own lives. What is your obstacle? And you'll have a chance to discuss that again in your prime groups this week. What obstacle is holding you back? What is the driven part of you that keeps you from trusting God? Because when we get to the spot of rest, it forces us to rely on him. And as scary as that place can be, it is an amazing place. And I am telling you, as one that has stepped out in different areas in my life, and I'm not saying I'm perfect, but the Bible says, taste and see that the Lord is good. There's going to be these moments where you're going to step out and you're going to be like, this is the scariest thing ever. And God's going to show up and you're going to go, wow, God knew what he was talking about. And then the next time you're like, you know what? It's still scary, but I'm going to do it again. And all of a sudden, you're not going to be a person living for you. You're going to be a person living and following what God is leading in your life. And it comes back to this idea of rest, because rest allows a driven person to trust. And I think there's a part of that in all of us, that we need to step back and trust that God is going to come through, because He said He would, and He is always faithful. He always keeps His promises. Let's pray. Father, thank You so much for Your word, and certainly we covered a lot of content here. But God, I just thank You for the overarching theme that we can trust You, and that You will always come through. And as we've said, and certainly for years of talking about how You want what's best for us, and Your desire is better than anything we could even dream up. And so I just pray for each of us, not to point fingers, not to look around, and not to just dismiss this, but to say, what about us needs to step back and trust? What part of us needs to rest so that we can see You come through? Where is the driven part of us that needs to come to Your feet and just say, God, this is Your thing, and let You do it? I pray that You would help us to do that. I just thank You for all the things that You have been doing in our lives, and that You are so faithful and so worth us trusting. In Jesus' name we pray. Amen.